Good morning. Several years ago, as a family, we purchased an old ski boat. This was when our family was getting larger, and it was kind of a way for us as a large family to enjoy being together, being active, being contained in one place. But my first few times using it, I made a ton of rookie mistakes. I'd never owned a boat before. As we started taking the boat on ministry trips, we took it on a camping trip with the young adult ministry. We had a camping site where we were right by the water, and so we could leave the boat there, we could anchor it, thinking it would be there the next morning. So the first time I did this, I didn't sleep hardly at all that night. I was terrified. I didn't even know really how to use an anchor or how it worked. So I put it there, and I went to bed in my tent, and I was worried, didn't sleep, woke up, came out of my tent, looked at the water, and I'll tell you what happened in a minute. This morning, we're continuing in our 10-month series on the life of David. We're calling it A Life of Passion. And we've seen David in different life stages. We've seen him as a shepherd, we've seen him anointed king, and now we're watching him on the run as a fugitive. The current king, Saul, is out to get him, he's trying to kill him, and David is fleeing. Last week, we saw David at his best. God had literally given Saul into David's hands, and David resisted the temptation to kill Saul in cold blood. He trusted God. He maintained his integrity. He was patient with God's plans. It was remarkable what David did. The David we meet this morning, as we look at 1 Samuel 25, seems like a completely different person. He is presumptuous, reactive, angry, and vengeful. He flies off the handle after being provoked. He reacts to a situation, and he is almost foolish. Almost, but not quite. The natural question that we as readers ask then is, what happened? Why did David change? What happened that made him change so quickly from being honorable into being violent and vengeful? The first surprise of David's story this morning is how that change occurs. But our text is going to help us. It's going to show us an event that I think we can realize is at least partly responsible for that change. Something happened that made David lose his anchor. It was as if he was adrift and he had lost his grounding and he didn't know where he was. This is what I was worried would happen to that boat. And this is what you'll find out whether it did happen later. The second big surprise in our story this morning is how quickly David actually recovers from this place. First, we're surprised at how soon he goes from a healthy place to a dark place, and then we'll be surprised as to how quickly he backs away from the edge, how he recovers his sense of who he is. So walking through David's story this morning, I think is going to help us because we face these kinds of things. We, in one moment, think everything's great, and we're doing fine, and everything is perfect. And then we make decisions that even shock ourselves. How could I do that? How could I go that far? And then we need to figure out, how do we react? How do we, when we lose our anchor, figure out what it takes to recover, to restore a sense of who we are? David's example is going to help us to understand that process, both how easy it is to get to a dark place and how God might intervene to help us get back. Well, the chapter begins with a simple announcement that at first seems like it has nothing to do with the overall story. Here's 1 Samuel 25, first part of verse 1. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. This event is understated by our narrator. Samuel has died, but it is incredibly significant. If you remember back to the beginning of 1 Samuel, how much time is spent on Samuel's birth? This is Samuel, the last of the judges. This is Samuel who was born to barren Hannah when she pleaded with God for a son. This is Samuel who anointed Israel's first king, Saul, and then told that king that God was going to tear the kingdom from his hands. This is Samuel who anointed secretly a forgotten eighth son to be Saul's replacement. Samuel died, all Israel mourned, and they moved on. But think about David. Think about how this must have impacted our fugitive on the run. I think that what must have really affected David is the fact that Samuel told him who he was. David's identity had come from Samuel. He was the one that said David was to be the king. He was the voice of God in David's life. He protected David. When Saul first started trying to kill David, David ran to Samuel's house first. Samuel was David's anchor, but Samuel was gone. David had lost his anchor. Has that ever happened to you? Have you gone through something where you feel like the rug has been torn out from under you? Have you lost something significant in your life? Have you lost an anchor? With Samuel gone, David probably wondered whether anyone would believe that he was supposed to be the next king. What if the anointing had died with Samuel? What if no one remembered? What if there was no one left to protect him? What if? What if? What if? With Samuel gone, I think David must have forgotten who he was. Who is David without Samuel? Most of us go through these kinds of changes that seem to affect our very identity. Something that we hold dear to ourselves or some role that we occupy changes, and we don't always know what to do with that. We graduate from school and start a job, and we go from being a student to being a working professional, and that's a huge shift. We change roles, or we change companies, or we change careers. We have children, or we watch children leave. Or we lose a child unexpectedly. We get married, or we watch a marriage fall apart. Or we lose our spouse and have to figure out what life looks like alone again. It's really easy to feel lost in those kinds of changes, to wonder who you are when that thing that seemed to give you some identity is gone or different. What do we do when we've lost our anchor? Well, as the story continues, we find out what David does, and he doesn't handle it well. We're all wondering this question, who is David going to be without Samuel? And we meet two characters that help to form that answer. They will show us David in a new light. One is a foolish man, the other is a wise woman. Here's how the story continues. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. So we meet Nabal and his wife, and they're described as polar opposites. Abigail, on the one hand, is discerning. She is of good insight. Something within her is good, and she is beautiful. Her exterior is good. Nabal is harsh. Something within him is hard and severe, and he is badly behaved. His external actions are awful. Abigail is good inside and out. Nabal is bad inside and out. So we, as the very savvy readers, immediately know we're supposed to like Abigail and distrust Nabal. Of course, David is on the run with his 600 men, but we have learned that as he's running from Saul, he's been helping people around him. So last week we saw him save the city of Keilah from the Philistines, and this week we find out that he's actually been protecting Nabal's shepherds as they take care of their flocks. So in return for that, he decides to ask for some kindness. He asks that he would be included in Nabal's feast. This is how he does that in verses 5 to 6. David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him, peace be to you and peace be to your house and peace be to all that you have. David's intentions are clear. He wants to bring peace to this man's house as he has been doing for some time now. It's a reasonable request. The feast day was a day when wealthy landowners would throw huge parties and invite the surrounding community. So this was a normal thing to ask to be included within. I think David is hoping for a little kindness. If you remember last week, the citizens of Keilah betrayed him. The Ziphites sold him out to Saul. His own men didn't understand why he didn't kill Saul at the moment. Now Samuel has died, and I think he's just hoping somebody will be nice to him. He asks to be included in Nabal's feast. We've heard about this guy briefly, but we're worried. We don't think this is going to end very well. And this is how it happens in verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my servants, for my shearers, and give it to men who come from I do not know where?" Last week, we saw people treat David this way as well. This week, Nabal follows suit. You know that person who always knows the perfect thing to say just at the right moment? Nabal's the other guy. He knows the worst possible thing that could be said at the worst possible moment. He walks into a tense situation, and he makes it worse. David is angry. He responds by telling his men to strap on their swords. They're going to go attack this guy. We actually find out later in the story, through a flashback, what David says to his men, and it is surprising. Listen to verses 21 through 22 here. "Now David had said, 'Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him.'" Last week, Saul praised David for returning good for Saul's evil. Now David complains that Nabal has returned evil for Saul's good. And so he's prepared to do what comes naturally to most of us, return evil for evil. This is a different David. He continues his speech by cursing in God's name with a vulgar reference to men. It's been cleaned up in our translation as one male, but the King James translates it literally as any that pisseth against the wall. Gone is the patient, honorable David who spared Saul's life. This David is reactive, coarse, vulgar, and violent. What's happened? Last week we were stunned by David's integrity and patience. Now we see a foul-mouthed, violent madman. Why this transformation? Our kitchen stove runs on gas. Maybe some of yours do as well. And when you light it, you turn the knob, and there's this clicking noise, right? And if all goes well, it goes click, 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 whoosh, and your burner is lit, right? But one of our burners in particular is kind of troublesome. It doesn't like to light right away. So it's always a bit of a panic. We actually usually light it with a lighter. But if we don't, you turn it on, and it goes click, 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 click. And you start to get nervous, right? Because you know that gas is filling your house at this point. And this thought process goes through your head, do I reach in to stop it? Or what if I reach in and at that very moment the fireball happens? And so you're like, how long do I wait for this clicking? Well, think about David. Think about the stuff he suffered in the story last week. Think about Samuel passing away. Think about the fact that he asked this guy to be nice to him, and you can just see that the gas is building up in his house. The situation is getting more and more tense. David has lost his anchor. He's wondering who he is without Samuel. He wants someone to reaffirm him. And what does Nabal do? He knows who David is. Everybody knows who David is. He's just being ignorant and mean. But he manages to ask the very question that provokes the insecurity, that David is feeling. He says, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? I don't know this guy. And that's the very question that David himself has been asking. Who am I? Who am I really without Samuel? So that becomes the spark that ignites the fireball. Nabal's question plays into the one thing that's going to set David off. And it's helpful for us to recognize what's going on in the story here, because when we lose our anchors, when we go through seasons like this, the same kind of thing can happen. When we forget who we are, and when we're insecure about something about ourselves or our role or our identity, we are vulnerable. We are prone to reacting in surprising ways, ways that are sometimes we become ashamed of later. But if we recognize those times, if we recognize that we're in a vulnerable place, we can look out for that spark. We can beware the spark that might set us off. Most of us have probably had this kind of experience where we say or do something and the person we're interacting with just goes crazy. And we say, what happened here? Why did they react so crazily to this little thing that just I did or said? Happens all the time in marriages, it happens in families, it happens with housemates, it happens in friendships. And we can often think, well, something else must be going on. This can't be exactly about this situation, because there's always a backstory. We don't know what any person is going through. We don't have the full visibility into what their lives are like. So in our best moments, we can recognize that perhaps they're going through something that contributed to this situation. But what's helpful is when we can realize that we're in that place, that we are feeling vulnerable, that we are feeling insecure, that we can recognize, I'm feeling like the gas is building up, like something might happen. I'm in a place where I know something small could set me off. When you're able to recognize that about yourself, it allows you to relate to people in a whole different way. You can offer that. You can admit that. You can warn people of that. When you know that you're in a vulnerable place, when you know that you've lost your anchor, you can beware that spark. David wasn't able to do that, so he erupted. But one of Nabal's servants recognized what was going on and figured he'd try and help out. He knew that going to his master was pointless, that this guy was a fool. But he goes to his wife, Abigail. And you get the sense that maybe Abigail has saved Nabal's hide in the past. That maybe the servants knew that if something was about to happen, it was the wife that was going to help. So he tells Abigail what's going to go on, and Abigail tries to clean up the mess. She starts by preparing this gift for David. Listen to verses 18 through 19. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seas of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she did not tell her husband, Nabal. Now, if you're familiar with your Old Testament history, this scene might remind you of a previous scene. Jacob and Esau were the grandsons of Abraham. And after 14 years of being estranged, Jacob tried to reunite with his brother. And in doing so, he went to meet him, and he sent ahead of him gifts, just like Abigail is doing. Now, Abigail was wise enough to give David what he asked for in the first place, a little food to feed his hungry men. But her actions also have the consequence of comparing him to Esau, the receiver of those gifts, who was the father of the Edomites, the sworn enemy of Israel. So in a sense, this is setting up this comparison that I think makes David ask, do I really want to be like Esau? Is that the character I want to be compared to? But remember that David is not in any type of reflective mood at the moment. He is on the warpath. He is on a rampage. And I think we have to wonder about this woman, Abigail. What kind of a woman sees an angry, violent, foul-mouthed man and steps in front of him, tries to intercede, sees that oncoming train and says, I'm going to try and stop this. A brave woman, a really brave woman, and a smart woman who knows how to speak, how to play her cards right, And that's what she does. In Hebrew narrative, the speech is the insight into the character's heart. So I want us to read Abigail's whole speech, to hear all of her words. But I figured instead of me reading it, I would ask a brave and brilliant woman that I know to read it for us. So Corey's going to come up and read Abigail's speech for us. Thanks, Corey.
On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please, let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living, in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause or for my Lord working salvation for himself. And when the Lord has dwelt with my Lord, then remember your servant.
Thanks, Corey. Abigail is brave and smart. This speech is brilliant, the way she ties together all these themes. She starts by taking responsibility for her stupid husband's actions, which of course had nothing to do with her. She uses language that reminds David of his victory over Goliath, the imagery of the sling being slung out, which of course had everything to do with God. And she points to the future, reminding David that he is going to be the king. But her main point hinges around two things. She's trying to prevent David from blood guilt and saving with his own hand. First off, she wants to save him from unnecessary, unjustified violence. Kings are supposed to be the protectors of their people. They're not supposed to be the ones that play out their personal vendettas by exacting revenge on their people. Of course, that's what Saul is doing. He's hunting David down because he's jealous of him. Abigail says, you don't want to be like that. She also wants to keep David from saving with his own hand. David should know that it is God who saves. Deuteronomy 32, 35 has God stating, it is mine to avenge. I will repay. And this idea that God is the one who exacts revenge, who brings justice for his people. This lies at the heart of what it means to trust in Yahweh. So the king of Israel, of all people, should know this and live by this principle. Incidentally, this is exactly what was so impressive about David in the story last week. He refused to act violently against Saul and kill him in cold blood. And he refused to take matters into his own hand, instead trusting that God would be the judge. Now it seems that David, having lost his anchor, has forgotten these things. So Abigail steps in to remind him. She reminds him of who he is. You are the king. Kings don't act like this. And she reminds him of who God is. God is the one who saves, not you. You don't save yourself. And I love this balanced reminder. On one hand, reminding him of who he is, but also reminding him that he is incredibly dependent on God. She says, you are the king, but even the king relies on God to save him. Thank God for people like this. We need people like this in our lives, people who remind us of who we are, people who remind us of who God is and how he acts in our lives. We especially need this reminder when we've lost our anchor. We especially need it when we're about to do something foolish. When you find yourself in that kind of a place, listen for the voice of God from others. Listen for the voice of God. What I like about this story is that it acknowledges that when we lose our anchors, we are prone to freaking out. Bad things might happen. But when we find ourselves in that place, God gives us opportunities. He sends people to us who can help us remember. The trick for us is to listen, and sometimes that's hard. I know that I've found when I'm in a place similar to David, there's a part of me that wants to give in to whatever's going on. It actually feels good. I want to give in to the anger or the lust or the jealousy or the pride or the self-pitying or the materialism or whatever it is. It seems like it would feel good to just let it run rampant. And so those voices that say, hey, but remember who you are. Remember who God is. Don't always come across as helpful at first. The trick is to get to a place where I can listen, where I can be reminded. In our story, the question is whether David can do that. Can he listen to Abigail? Can he let her talk him out of this foolish action? Listen to 1 Samuel 25:32-33. And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand." This is incredible. David realizes exactly what Abigail has done for him. And again, we are shocked at his transformation. From integrity to violent vulgarity, and now he's blessing God. Now he's thankful that God has stopped him from these actions. How many angry, violent men do you know who are so easily reminded of God's presence and purposes in their lives? Here is the answer to our question that we've been wondering this whole story. Who really is David? Well, he is somebody that is capable of things we'd rather he not be capable of. He is somebody that can get to some dark places. But he is somebody who is teachable. He is somebody who repents, who listens to the voice of God in the people around him. And this will be surprising. Over and over again in David's story, he listens to people, women, generals, prophets, children, beggars, all sorts of people. David listens to them, and he changes. He changes his decisions. He changes his actions because of the words of these people. The opposite of true is true of Abigail's husband. When he finds out that his wife had to step in to save him, this is what happens in verse 37. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. 10 days later, the text says he died for good. So Nabal was so devastated by the idea that someone else had to step in and save him that he lost his very life. On the other hand, David was so grateful that somebody stepped in and saved him that after Nabal died, he invited Abigail to come and be his wife. He knew he needed someone that was willing to be the voice of God in his life, to be around him. And all of this really comes back to Abigail's warning to David. He was about to save himself, but she warned him against that. And he relented, first by letting God save him, by being the judge between him and Nabal, but also by listening to Abigail. He let Abigail save him by being God's voice in his life. He was humble enough to let this woman save him from a huge mistake. What about us? What about you? Do you try to save yourself? Do you think you're in charge of bringing justice to people who have hurt you or insulted you or forgotten you? Are you unwilling to listen to the voice of people in your life that try to warn you against making mistakes? Are you more like Nabal or like David. This passage is a warning. It's a warning about what can happen when we lose our anchor. A warning about how easily people who do honorable things can change and do foolish things. It's a warning against trying to save ourselves. Listen to this warning. Don't save yourself. At first, that language might not immediately resonate with you. Maybe you say, well, you know, I've never led a gang of 400 men to murder somebody who's insulted me, so I think I'm all right. But think about those times when you feel like you've lost your anchor. What do you do when you're in a vulnerable place like that? What do you do when you're insulted or provoked? There's all sorts of ways that we might save ourselves in those moments. We're certainly tempted to return evil for evil, like David is about to do, to take revenge against people who have hurt us, to defend ourselves, to attack someone else, to insist on our rights and our privileges. It's easy to justify these things by saying, well, the other person started it. It's exactly what David said. But maybe you're more passive. Maybe you don't tend to go on the offense. Maybe you go on the defense. Maybe you retreat or hide or isolate yourself or try to say that those things never happened or push people away. You tell yourself that you can't trust anyone and you find yourself alone. What does it look like for you to save yourself? How are you tempted to do that? When you lose an anchor, what kind of a place do you get to? My hope is that this morning we would be reminded that God is our anchor. God gives us our identity. God tells us who we are. God tells us that we are, in fact, kings. We reign with him, and that he is the one who saves us. Remember what he says in Isaiah 43:1. But now thus says the Lord, he who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. Doesn't mean that we're not affected when we lose significant things in our lives. Doesn't mean that we skate above life on this kind of spiritual plane. We're affected by things. We can lose those anchors, but ultimately we can be reminded that God is our anchor. He is who we return to, and we can cling to him instead of having to save ourselves. Remember that camping trip I took with the young adults and the boats out on the water? Well, I woke up that morning groggily because I hadn't slept well, and I poked my head out of the tent and I stood up and I looked at the water, and there was the boat, anchored just where I had left it. It turned out, though, that I had a different problem, because when we tried to leave later that weekend, I couldn't get the anchor up. It was lodged so tightly I couldn't remove it, and I ended up snapping my rope and leaving the anchor, forever donating it to the bottom of that lake. In a funny way, I think the same kind of thing ended up happening for David. Abigail helped him to rediscover his anchor. I think he recognized how much he needed that and asked her to become his wife. But the chapter ends with this strange addendum. Listen to verses 43 and 44. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Galim. So we meet this incredible woman, Abigail. She completely impresses David. Her husband dies. He marries her. Why then are we told also that he takes another woman? Why are we told that Michal, his first wife, was taken from him and given to someone else? I think it's a foreshadowing of some trouble to come. Abigail helped David rediscover his anchor, but perhaps David ends up relying too much on women in his life. Perhaps instead of really understanding that God is his anchor, he sees this woman as his anchor. Perhaps that might come back and cause some problems in his life later on. And of course, we know that it will. This story is a foreshadowing of another story. Abigail and Nabal foreshadows Bathsheba and Uriah. At the end of both of those stories, a man is dead and David has his wife. In this case, that woman had saved David from himself and pulled him back from doing something foolish. In the story of Bathsheba and Uriah, nothing was able to save David from himself. And so we hear this story, and we're grateful for Abigail and thankful for God working through her, but we know that sometimes it doesn't always work out that way. And so we are warned, and we're concerned for David and for ourselves. When David loses his anchor, Abigail helps him find it. We've seen this new side of David this morning, and we're kind of scared by it, but we also are impressed at his ability to listen to people. And we think about ourselves, and we think about what we might be capable of, and whether we are really willing to listen to people when they speak to us in God's name. Have you lost an anchor? Are you in a vulnerable place? We need to be careful in those moments. We need to recognize that we're in that kind of a place and know that something could set us off and make us do foolish things. Listen to the voice of God. Look for God intervening in your life to pull you back, to remind you who you are and who God is in your life. Above all, don't save yourself. Let others in. Let them be the voice of God for you. The Lord is the only one who saves. Only God, through Jesus Christ, saves our lives and our souls. When you've lost your anchor, don't be foolish. Let God save you. Amen.